Hello, everybody. Welcome back to This Weird House. I am, as always, Nick Bodick, and today, for the first time, we have three guests, three of the people on my personal Mount Rushmore of horror fiction. We have Matt Bartlett, we have Laird Barron, and we have John Langan. I am not meaning to imply anything by the ordering of your names.
Oh my God. How's it going, guys? Oh my God, bud. All right, fine. I can see how this is going to be. Let's just get this over with.
I feel like if I wouldn't have said anything about it, you still would have brought it up.
Possibly.
So this is just a kind of an impromptu episode for the forthcoming holiday. Halloween is coming up, and I just kind of wanted to get a bunch of my favorite authors together and talk scary stuff. So the most important question for three horror writers during the Halloween season: what is your favorite candy?
Butterfingers.
Solid choice.
A bold choice. No one's gonna say candy corn.
I'm okay with candy corn. I don't get all the hate for it, but
I don't either. It's not my favorite, but my favorite would just perennially the Reese's peanut butter cup.
That's my all time.
That is a good choice.
In the freezer.
Yes.
The freezer. Bold choice, Bartlett.
Yeah.
Along with the gin. Yeah. I think maybe like a Milky Way. I think I might have to go with the Milky Way.
Over a Snickers?
Yeah.
It's a soft choice.
Special dark. What was that?
That was my wife saying special dark.
Hershey's
special dark bar. And that's appropriate, I think. For
also good. Yep. Little bitter. Yep.
Yeah. Regarding candy corn, I loved it when I was a kid. I would eat it all year round. My grandma somehow had a never ending stash of it, just always ready to go. Always had a bowl for whenever I came over. It could be July, it could be February, anytime. And then I soured on it for like a good, I'd say 10 years. And I had it for the first time in at least a couple of years yesterday, day before yesterday. And it is okay. It's very middle of the road. I was not impressed. I was not let down.
If you happen by a liquor store, there is a candy corn flavored hard cider.
Really?
I do not recommend it. Unless you just
want it. This is like a public service announcement, like a warning. It's out there. Watch out for it.
Well, you know, try it so that you can warn others. That's my.
So you could say you did.
Shouldn't you be able to tell though when they pour it in the glass and you hold it up and it's like all the different colors? Shouldn't that be your first clue?
Yep.
I had a chocolate candy corn the other day, in addition to the regular kind. That was actually much better than the original for me. Yeah. But okay, so it's the spooky season. What do you guys have any go-to horror movies that you like? Say, I mean, Halloween season or not, you sit down, you're in the mood for a horror movie. What are you going for?
For Halloween themed specifically, I like Halloween 3: Season of the Witch, and of course the classic Halloween. And for a lighter movie that's full of Halloween atmosphere. And this will, you know, this is not for people who dislike Adam Sandler, but Hubie Halloween, yes, for me is a really fun, silly, but like completely Halloween suffused movie that I really enjoy putting on this time of year.
Yeah, Hubie Halloween was a totally out of left field. I loved Adam Sandler growing up. My mom and I watched all his movies 100 times, and I hadn't watched any of his new stuff because I'd seen a few of his his dramatic stuff is incredible, but like his comedies hadn't really done anything for me. But I watched Hubie Halloween on a whim, and I absolutely loved it. It was much better than I expected it to be. How about you, Laird or John, whoever?
No, that's fine. That's fine. You made your pick. Go ahead, Laird.
God damn it.
I will.
I know you will.
So we're having Halloween month. We're trying to watch a few horror movies. Our Jessica's go-to is we watch The Crow on Halloween every year. I think that's probably her favorite, but mine, and so I watch it with her. I think mine is probably, I always watch The Thing during October at some point.
Hell yeah.
And if I miss, that's kind of my go-to. But if I miss out, if like for some reason I don't watch it in Halloween, during the Halloween month, I'll watch it in like February when it's really cold. Nasty outside. But yeah, The Crow. I mean, you know, it's funny. We've been doing that for about 12. This will be the 12th time. After the first 4 years, I'm like, oh my God, not again. It's happening again. But then you just become numb. It's like you drink yourself sober. You just keep going and going. And finally, like, I'm kind of looking forward to it this year.
Yeah, you go all the way around the block.
I'm back to like, oh, what's this? This will be great. Maybe there's something I saw everything. I know exactly what's going to happen, but that's fine.
I don't know how I feel about the new Crow that's coming out with Bill Skarsgård. I'm usually all for remakes and stuff. Disconnected from the first entirely. The trailer did not impress me all that much. And so, yeah, I don't know. I'm going to see it, but I'm intrigued to see what they did with it. If anything new at all. How about you, John?
Well, I have watched not only The Crow, but the sequels, the sort of City of Angels and whatever the other one was. So I probably will watch this new one, but like on streaming when it's free. But that's not, we're not bashing The Crow, not yet. I think as far as Halloween movies go, Carnival of Souls, which is a black and white one from about 1960, about an hour and change long, that is just utterly bizarre. There's also one, and it's funny, you can find Carnival of Souls in this another film called something like Horror Hotel. I think it had a couple of different titles, but it stars Christopher Lee for once as a good guy who's dealing with an evil coven that have taken over a small town. And it's surprisingly effective. You know, it doesn't seem from the write-up. I remember when I watched it, I was like, well, okay, whatever. You know, I've got an hour to kill or an hour and a half to kill. But it's actually really, it's quite good. So I think those are good. I kind of like, for Halloween itself, I like something that's sort of black and white, you know, atmospheric, really, you know, like a Val Lewton movie or something like that, where it just really feels timeless in an odd kind of way. I mean, I would agree. Yeah, all the Halloween movies, Carpenter, you know, you really can't go wrong with any of them.
I started watching Maxine last night. And it's not an indictment of the movie. I didn't finish. I got about halfway. It was just really late. Mm-hmm. I decided I would just watch the second half tonight. But that's actually pretty good. I'm actually like, I kind of like Ty West. I liked House of the Devil a whole lot.
House of the Devil.
Yeah, I thought that was a really effective movie. I didn't mind X. I thought X was okay. But I really liked House of the Devil. And this is interesting character art that he's, you know, I think this is a pretty neat like little trilogy that he's got going.
Yeah, I didn't like X. I liked Pearl well enough, but I really, really like Maxine.
Yeah, I'm just right, like dab smack in the middle of it. It's really good so far. Kevin Bacon, I'm quite enjoying.
Yeah, he's really enjoying it.
But anyway, I just thought I'd toss that in for anybody out there sees this. And so far, so good. It's really filmed. It's beautifully filmed.
Yeah, I'm actually about halfway through Long Legs right now. That finally became affordable to stream. And that one's terrific so far.
Yeah, I just watched it the other night. It was good.
I just watched it a couple weeks ago. It was, yeah, that one was, I mean, that, when I was watching it, I was thinking it was the most Nick Cage has ever been, but I still think Mandy beats it out. But yeah. Mandy is—they just let him off the leash completely.
Yeah,
I watch that movie. I'm not kidding. Like probably like a good four times a year. That's Mandy's one of my all-time favorite.
Long Legs is great. Mandy's an all-timer for me.
Yeah,
and I have a lot of theories about that one. Like Nick Cage, I think that is my favorite role of his.
Mm-hmm.
Or one of them. I mean, he's done Academy Award, you know, stuff, but I. You know, serious films, but I really, really thought he did a great job in that one and was really entertaining. And I'm like you, I've seen it 6-7 times.
Yeah, it's like, it's just, it's the only movie I've I watch where it feels like there really just was no limit to what they were doing. And like, it's a weird way to put it, but it just felt like every time I watch it, I don't mean this literally, but like it almost feels like something different could happen. It's just that chaotic and just ridiculous and incredible. Now I got to watch that again. So thanks.
Yeah, that was, I mean, for what it's worth, you know, I remember the first time I watched the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that was how I felt with that movie, that it was just, there were no limits. It was just going to go as far as it could possibly go. Cronenberg's remake of The Fly for me was also like that, that every time you got to these points where you thought, well, they can't possibly go any further than this, and boom, they went, you know, and there was something, and Mandy's like that too. There's something about these works of art where the director, you know, the whole thing, right? They're not going to stop until the very end of the film. There's never going to be a moment where they take it back. There's never going to be a moment of it was all a dream, or oh, the good guys won, or whatever. There's never going to be a monologue on the part of the villain saying, as you know, no, it's just straight on till morning.
The last thing I'll say about Mandy is just that it's mythic, and it struck me as, you know, Red Miller is not a human being. He's a god, obviously sleeping, and he wakes up to his past. That's kind of made manifest to me when he goes and sees his fellow brother god in the trailer, and the CB is actually an oracular device. I've heard on the CB, and it's giving me all this stuff. And he has his named crossbow, the Reaper. I think it was called the Reaper, but it's named. I mean, who names, you know, no, this was, and then you have the fire or the frost giants. I mean, obviously the guy with the 6 foot bar on his saw, that's a frost giant. Yeah. If I ever saw one.
Right.
On and on. And then Mandy herself, not a human being. Mandy's a dryad probably a dryad. She's a protector of the forest. And that's made manifest when she's looking at the full or the fawn that's decomposing. And it's just, in my mind, my headcanon is he's dallying with, he's kind of forgotten who he's Thor. He's one of the other old gods, and he's living life as a mortal, or at least, you know, this quiet kind of retired life with someone else, you know, in the forest, a forest spirit. And of course, opposites attract, right? Because he's hacking down trees, but she's like, well, just leave these alone over here. Yeah. So I have all kinds of fun with that movie. I asked Panos about that, and he kind of laughed. Wouldn't confirm or deny.
Oh man, I want to talk.
But he did laugh about it. He was like, "Oh, baby."
I love his first one, Beyond the Black Rainbow. That was that was a bizarre film watching experience for me. I had no idea what it was going into. I'd never heard of Panos Cosmatos before. I just, a buddy of mine put it on, and we just started watching it, and by 10 minutes in, I was completely just enthralled. And then I remember I left his house, went home, and watched it again by myself, and I was just like, holy shit, this guy is just doing things I've never seen before. So
I can't wait.
I can't wait till he comes out with something next. I think he has a movie done, like in the bag already, and just waiting for it to come out. But
yeah, I was wondering if what was next. You know, I like you, Nick, I think I heard something, but it was just in passing.
Yeah, for sure.
And he had a segment on that Netflix Guillermo del Toro
Cabinet of Curiosities.
Okay. Yeah, and his segment was among the best, I thought.
Which one did he do? Was he the autopsy?
I'll never remember the name of it now.
Okay. Yeah.
Just tell us the whole plot, Bartlett. Spoil it for us. Come on, man.
Start to finish.
Celebrities meet in a parking garage and they head to the house of this weird guru type character.
Okay, now I remember.
So like a typical kind of convention is what you're saying.
Exactly like that. Yeah, all it needed was Michael Cisco and it was
He's there. He's always there. Just look in the corners. You'll see him in the shadows.
I loved Cabinet of Curiosities. Most of it. Dreams in the Witch House was disappointing, to say the least. But I thought Pickman's model was done well enough that it made up for the travesty that was Dreams in the Witch House. Because that wasn't even it was Dreams in the Witch House in name only.
Right.
It shared no plot similarities or anything, but it was cool to see them, and I know it's been done before, but just directly adapting Lovecraft's stories, which are obviously notoriously difficult to do direct adaptations of, and that's why you get so many things that are like Lovecraftian but not just outright Lovecraft adaptations. Do you guys have any like particularly favorite Lovecraftian horror movies or shows you can point to?
There was an adaptation by the I'm not going to remember that. I think they're the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. They did Whisperer in Darkness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I think it's streaming on Tubi now, and that was terrific. And the stand-in for Miskatonic University was right in South Hadley, right nearby, a beautiful college campus of Mount Holyoke.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which added a little extra kind of coolness for me, but otherwise just a really well done, almost a, you know, close to a direct adaptation of the actual story without a bunch of trying to, you know, pretty it up or add a lot of extraneous plot elements.
Yeah.
They also did, before that, a shorter adaptation of The Call of Cthulhu, a silent film. And I think that's the bee's knees, man. I think that's just terrific. I think even that there's some sort of stop motion at the end that's a little cheesy, but it kind of fits. Like of course it would be cheesy because this is how it would have been done in 1927 or whatever, when the film is supposed to have been made. So I think in terms of direct adaptations, those are among the most interesting. I would I'd be curious to see what else they do. I don't know if the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society, I don't know if they have other films in the offing, but I hope they do, because I'd like to see more from them.
I also, if I had to pick a direct adaptation, it would for sure be The Call of Cthulhu, the silent film. That was such a cool way of going about that. But,
there was also a film that was, I think it was called Cthulhu or titled Cthulhu, but it was actually an adaptation of The Shadow Over Innsmouth, kind of.
Yeah. And Tori Spelling.
Tori Spelling's in it. Yeah, yeah. And she also produced it. And it's about a guy returning home, and he's gone out. I think he's in the West Coast, maybe. But he's like...
Yeah, it's West Coast.
Well, and he's gone out. I can't remember if he's an actor or what he is, but he comes back home and he doesn't fit in. And they have certain things they want him to do, you can imagine. It was surprisingly effective. And it has a wonderful sort of closing shot that just sort of opens up the movie in all kinds of really, really wonderful ways.
Huh. That's crazy. I don't think I've even heard of that one.
Yeah, it's a good movie. It's like 2010 or something.
Yeah.
Oh.
So many.
It's very good.
Yeah, and so many of them are just, you know, you find them on Shudder or Tubi or whatever. They're these low budget without, and I don't mean that as a condemnation. I just mean that they're made for not the budget of a typical Hollywood blockbuster, and they're still able to do these amazing things.
The only thing I'll say about it is they're almost always disappointing, because I don't think it's hard to adapt Lovecraft. I just don't think that the stories lend themselves to cinema in the same way without adding a lot of stuff to them to make a movie experience. I mean, times have changed, but I predict it doesn't really matter who does it. Everybody's clamoring for Mountains of Madness. They're going to be very, very sad when they get Mountains of Madness. If it's a straight adaptation, it's not, it's just, to me, it's not something that is particularly going to be interesting without overhauling it and adding characterization and stuff. Basically a catalog. Having talked to a lot of producers and seeing how stuff gets made and what they look for when they deconstruct a a manuscript and try to turn it into a movie. The Mountains of Madness, there's a reason why nobody's adapted it, because you literally cannot adapt Mountains of Madness for a feature-length film without turning it into something else. And Tom Cruise, everybody's like, damn it, Tom Cruise is going to do it. I'm like, yeah, it's going to be Mission Impossible, but in, you know, at the Mountains of Madness, and there's going to be
explosions. Mission Impossible 9 at the Mountains of Madness.
Yeah, I just, everybody wants the impossible, and I'm like, there's nothing, it won't be a, you know, somebody like Panos could probably do it, or some nihilistic German director, you know, somebody that...
Werner Herzog at the Mountains of Madness.
Sure. Or Kurosawa, you know, somebody, not, you know, the young Kurosawa.
Yeah.
Like somebody that goes, no, we're going to do this mood piece. And they would do it right. They would follow the book. They would do their interpretation of it, but it'd be as close as they could get to the novella. And no one will fucking like it. I promise you. Everybody would go, what is this? I'm like, it's the story. So... I feel very sorry for everybody when they finally get this, because either it's going to be really true to the novella and they'll be disappointed, or it won't be and they'll be disappointed. That's my pessimistic. That's my guarantee, actually.
Disappointment all around.
Yeah, this is something. Just fucking forget it and move on to the next thing. The best Lovecraft is interpreted Lovecraft anyway, by stuff that's just Lovecraft adjacent.
Yeah, I mean, you could make... There was actually a fascinating little thing that popped up on social media where some guy was arguing to his mom. He was saying, the Lego movie is perfect cosmic horror. And she said, what? How'd that? Come on. But he walked through it. And, you know, no, it's not going to frighten you, right? But in terms of... as a way to understand how cosmic horror works...
Neither will Lovecraft.
Yeah, well... as to understand how cosmic horror works, you know, you have people who are living in this universe. Their universe makes sense to them. It's all these little Lego blocks and whatever. But then there are also these powers that they just cannot comprehend, that every now and again just swoop in and change things around. There are these artifacts, what is it, like a Q-tip or something like that, that make no sense to them because they come from literally like a different sort of space-time and all this. It was quite entertaining, but I think that aside, I mean, I think you could make the argument, the original Alien, there's a lot of the feeling of the vastness and the vastness of the cosmos and
the
impersonality of the cosmos, the thing, Event Horizon, I think.
Love Event Horizon.
I think that what a lot of these films do, though, like with Event Horizon, say, you know, the actual horror, like what actually happens is, in a sense, outside the film. What you're just seeing is the effect of it. So that the characters have this encounter with something unimaginable and it just drives them nuts. And then they're here to share the madness with you. With Alien, in a sense, the original Alien, this is for as frightening as the alien, the xenomorph itself is, in a sense, I think where the real sort of cosmic horror slash wonder lies is in the space jockey and in that massive ship before Ridley Scott lost his mind and decided to tell us what it was. But initially, when you just see this vast alien creature, you know, fossilized creature in this vast alien ship, and there are all these, you don't even know if the eggs in that ship are like, if they belong on that ship or if they're from the surrounding environment and they've just kind of moved into that ship. So there's this whole, there's this whole universe that's suggested, and it is not a pleasant place.
Not at all. That's true. All that's true. That's what I've kind of thought about that as well. The implications of the wider cosmos were what really, for me, really drove the picture.
Well, I was listening.
The claustrophobia of being trapped on the ship. Like I was telling Jessica the other day that, you know, if you have a small group of people on a small boat and there's a tiger loose with them, so someplace where you can't get away and you turn loose a tiger and you don't, what are you going to do about it? It weighs 800 pounds. You have a stick. Like, all right,
right.
I'm going to bite him off with a spatula. So the bottom line is, the real horror was this juxtaposition of, they're intimate, they're stuck together, this little tiny environment. You can't really even run because everybody knows that you try running through places with pipes sticking out. I mean, it's impossible. And yet the backdrop is the space jockey and this wider universe. And all this is just this little tiny this little speck of activity.
Well, I was listening to an interview. I think it was with Johnny Compton, who's a really interesting newer writer. And he was talking about the movie, and he said, you know, one of the things he noticed many watchings through the film was that the workers, as it were, because it is basically just a work crew. It's like you and all the people you work with, right? Your little office, you know, whatever, cubicle, whatever. Like they're walking past these things, and at no point do they say, oh my God, this will change the shape of human history. They're just like, eh, which suggests either that they're numbed to it, you know, I mean, which is possible, right? They just have a job to do, or also that it's just that there is this kind of enormous background that everybody's just used to. Oh yeah, you know, the universe is full of all this weird stuff, all these relics of dead civilizations, whatever. We have to check out this signal. We just have this job to do so we can get home. So yeah, it you're right, Laird, that the more you think about the repercussions of it, the order that that Ash is following, whatever that is, that says, you know, we have to get this thing back to Earth, even if everybody else is killed, right? That suggests that they've encountered things like this before for that order to be in place.
Oh yeah, that's what I've always thought. And I kind of wonder if Ligotti watched. I think everybody's seen Alien, but I kind of wonder if Ligotti liked it or was influenced by it one way or another, because that's proto Ligotti corporate horror.
Corporate horror, yeah, corporate horror in space.
Well,
right?
I mean, really, it really is. I mean, sometimes people are glib and they try to like do their little dissertation about it's really capitalism, but the story really is grounded in.
Oh yeah, like, yeah.
The whole reason that they go there is they get their arms twisted. There's that whole scene where Brad and, you know, Ripley, they're all arguing about whether they should go check the signal out, and they're good horror movie people. Like, no, let's go home. We don't want to go anywhere.
Stay
near
out
this.
Of this, right.
And Ash is like, well, actually, or maybe it was Dallas, the captain, but they were looking at the fine print of the contract and says, you know, if you don't go do this, you're going to lose your share. They were completely threatened with their livelihood. So they were compelled to go there. What were they compelled by? They were compelled by a 2-year mission. They were going to get nothing.
Yeah.
For it. So that was the poverty and kind of economic slavery was as much of a, you know, the horror of the show.
Right.
And which the Aliens carries on, you know, Paul Reiser is the big
villain. Oh, absolutely. The corporation. Not, guess what? We've also set up a town. We've set up a company town in that place. You know, yeah, I think that
but I wonder if Ligotti, you know, because Ligotti is sort of the king of corporate horror there. And speaking of him, I will say one other thing. Empty Man. I was thinking about that the other day because somebody brought it up. I watched it in the hospital, actually. Perfect. I was just like paralyzed lying there watching this thing at 2 a.m.
And it's a laugh.
I was waiting for the nurse to come and take some more blood. And, you know, it strikes me, though, in retrospect, that I don't know if Nick will get this because we're geezers, but it struck me as a horror, a Ligottian retelling of the parallax view with Warren Beatty. Like, literally, that story, you know, there's differences, but I won't, you know, I don't want to go too far because of how it ends, but yeah, I was looking in retrospect, I was like, yeah, this could be Warren Beatty investigating, you know, this weird cult-like situation.
Right.
Yeah. I guess this corporation, but it's very Ligottian regardless. It's not even funny.
Huh. Well, it's funny. Somebody like Stefan Zemianowicz or someone had pointed out, and this is years ago, that when you think about Lovecraft stories and the monsters and these vast monsters and blah, 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 you know, he was like, think about it. You know, Lovecraft is writing before and then in the middle of and then through, you know, the stock market, the boom, the crash, the Great Depression. You know, this is certainly a time when people's lives are at the sway of these vast impersonal forces, you know, and it's not just H.G. Wells's Martians, but it's, you know, these sort of economic forces that have no concern for you or me. They're only concerned with value for the stockholders. And if that means that they have to sacrifice, you know, a few people on the Nostromo or all the people on the Nostromo, no problem, because, you know, Elon Musk will get his money or whoever.
That's right.
Yeah, I've been meaning to do a rewatch of the Alien franchise again. There's so many now, which is cool, mostly. But so I have I'm blanking on one. So my all-time favorite Lovecraftian horror film it's called The Endless.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. Sure.
Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. That to me, in my opinion, is like a perfect Lovecraftian story that's, you know, not based on anything directly of his.
What was the one they made before that, Nick? What was the
Resolution?
Resolution. You don't get nearly as much out of The Endless if you don't. Resolution. Oh, it's not necessary because they got really Hollywood by the time they got to Endless, but Resolution is my favorite of them.
Well, I just think that those two go together in such a cool way because we see them again in The Endless. You know,
The Endless is a sequel. We don't see them; they're gone. I see what you're saying. Yeah. They're at that point. They're trapped, but yeah, because it's a sequel to the. And then you have The Spring in the middle, which I didn't enjoy as much, but I thought it was a great movie. I just didn't believe it. But the other two I really love.
Yeah, I like Spring. Even the new one, Something in the Dirt, I thought was interesting.
Loved it.
Yeah.
They're great.
Yeah.
They're great.
I think they're hitting the cosmic thing. I think it's good that you mentioned them, Nick. I think that they're really persistently hitting that kind of cosmic thing in different ways. I mean, what I like in Resolution, right, is that you realize that these guys are living out, you know, they're playing out what seems to be this, I'm going to kidnap my friend and I'm going to hold him in this place until he gets clean, right? And then it's like there's something else that's watching this that's like, huh, this is interesting. Let me just see what happens what if we play it out this way? What if we play it out that way? And there's, it's one of those movies that I think the more you think about it afterwards, you know, and have conversations with your dorm buddies about it at 3 a.m. when you're all drunk and you're like, listen, man, like it's the kind of movie that really just grows in your mind.
Yeah.
I was really stunned how good obviously The Endless is sort of a culmination at that point of they have more money. They're pros by this point, they're polished, but Resolution is a genius. And it goes back to why I think that Lovecraft adjacent stuff is almost always better than direct adaptations, because lots of people can do cosmic horror, but in other words, Lovecraft did cosmic horror, but he couldn't write human characters really very effectively. Certainly not relationships. They're just a flat affect character that goes and has terrible things happen to him, sometimes in the omniscient. But Moorhead, you know, they get relationships. I mean, that's what made Endless and Resolution so powerful, is that I was invested in him trying to help his friend, his buddy.
Yeah.
Absolutely invested in him. I knew people like this in Alaska. We've all known people like this, and it was very relatable.
Yeah, they're really good at that. All their films, well, the four I've seen, I guess, they all seem to rely on that, right? That there's some central relationship, and that becomes the kind of lens through which the cosmic stuff is focused.
And it's relatable people.
Yeah.
You don't have to necessarily sympathize with them, but you understand kind of where they're coming from, whether you agree with it or not. You get it. Yeah. And I think that's the secret to why they're... And then bad things happen, and you are really sucked into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, those guys are really killing it right now. They're on the Disney machine now. They've done episodes of a bunch of different Marvel shows, and like, it's so cool.
That's
seeing
right,
that.
Moon Knight, right? I think they directed some, and maybe the second season of Loki as well.
Yep. And
I have to help a cat with something. I'll be right back.
Yeah. And yeah, they also have a bunch of episodes of the upcoming Daredevil series.
Oh, wow. Okay. Good for them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to get them on this show so bad. I have so many questions about like The Endless in particular, but their whole filmography that I want to talk to them about.
Well, I think one of the things the Endless gets is, you remember there's a scene where they're wandering through that that sort of vista, and there's all those weird sculptures just receding into the distance. Like, those are the kinds of details that, for me, can really make a cosmic horror film. You know, can really just give that suggestion that there is this vast, strange, not just universe, but kind of history out there that we may know nothing about, and we probably won't know anything about, but it's implied that it's there. It's funny, you know, there was another, what this makes me think of is, there was another small film, and I wish I could remember if it was called Sunfish or Starfish or something like that. And
Starfish.
Was it Starfish? That's the one about
the girl
who gets like sort of pushed into this like sort of alternate cosmos, but she kind of keeps moving through different alternate cosmoses. And I remember there's a scene in that where she steps outside, and for just a moment there's this vast creature that's like rampaging through a building, this strange thing. There was a lot. Like, I still remember it, you know, that there was, I don't know what I thought of the ending. But I know that the middle part of it, I thought that the most of the movie, I thought was doing some really, really interesting stuff.
I will have to check that one out. I haven't even heard of that one.
Yeah, me neither. Put that on my list.
Yeah. I can't remember. I don't know if Laird told me about it or if I just sort of ran across it online or something, but
it was about 5 years ago now.
Yeah.
It was right before COVID or right when COVID started. It's within recent memory.
Yeah.
And it got a small release. You know, it's an independent, but yeah.
Yeah. Lovecraftian or otherwise, I guess it'd be sort of difficult to do in a Lovecraftian, maybe. Who are your guys' favorite horror villains? Let's stick with movies for now. All-time favorite horror movie villains. Or I could say, who's the scariest one to you, and who's your favorite, if those happen to be two separate answers.
Oh.
Hmm.
So, you know...
Probably, go ahead.
No, please. I insist.
Then I will.
Okay. Yeah, I knew you would.
Anton Chigurh.
Yes.
I don't know if he's the scariest. The scariest is probably the judge, also by McCarthy. From Blood Meridian. That's all I have to say about that.
I just this afternoon, actually, I was watching a video on John Glanton and the Glanton gang, and they, you know, all the people who throughout, you know, historians and stuff who've tried figuring out if Judge Holden was indeed a real person, and if so, who exactly he was. And like, just the way that, and I know a lot of his book is considered, I guess, fiction, whatever you want to call it. Samuel Chamberlain, his memoirs, I think, is what they are. And it's where he describes Judge Holden and where McCarthy got his own description of him, basically. And like, he's written as though he is the actual devil, like in this, what this guy purports to be his true accountings of his experiences in the wars and, just, you know, his life or whatever, knowing this guy, he writes everybody else in his whole thing is written as like, oh, this guy was terrible. He killed a whole bunch of people in this village and didn't think twice about it. And this guy here, he would steal money from a baby or whatever. But then he, right in the middle of all this, he writes about this Judge Holden, who is, you know, 6'5", moves as gracefully as, you know, anybody he's ever seen. And he, you know, just all these crazy characteristics, like he writes him like he's the actual devil that it's terrifying. I agree. I think Judge Holden is probably the scariest villain in all of fiction for me. That's a long-winded way of saying that.
it's funny, you know, when I was a kid, Frankenstein's monster freaked me out. And I honestly, you know, thought I was long past that. But a few years ago, I watched a movie that was called something like The Frankenstein Tapes, and it was a sort of a found footage film about these a guy who discovers that, oh, my great-great-grandfather was Dr. Frankenstein, and he fled and he came to Canada. I believe this was a Canadian film. And, you know, he continued his work up here in the mountains. And so, of course, they go up into the mountains, the Canadian Rockies, I guess. And there is, you know, the monster is up there. But there was and there was a scene, you never actually see the monster, really. But there's a scene where they're out in a kind of a broad meadow that has all these little trees in it. And the monster is behind one of those trees, and the trees are shaking, and the monster is just howling. And holy cow, was I scared. So there's a way in which I think that, you know, what the monster... what that vision of the monster represents, not Shelley's articulate, you know, tortured soul, but this thing that is just this massive rage, this giant massive rage. I still find that really, really frightening. It's tempting to say, oh, you know, Hannibal Lecter, and maybe as Lecter was maybe played by Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs, there might be an argument to be made there. But even then, he teeters on the brink of being a kind of romantic anti-hero. In the same way, I mean, excuse me, Mads Mikkelsen is in the Lecter, the brilliant, brilliant Hannibal show. So I think in terms of like actual characters, I'm not sure who I would pick. You know, so many of the great monsters seem inarticulate. The ones who are articulate, you know, Freddy Krueger, right? I mean, how long does it take for Freddy to devolve into puns? I mean, even in the first movie, right? It's right there. It's like, you know, yes, he was a child murderer, but he's so funny, you know.
I think it just occurred to me that I think my favorite are Roman and Minnie Castevet in Rosemary's Baby. Mm. The, you know, seemingly, you know, slightly annoying elderly couple that take an interest in Rosemary's pregnancy. And they, by the end, hail Satan in the living room, you know,
right.
such a depiction of almost these kind of banal people who turn into, you know, these absolute creeps with designs on you know, on Rosemary to give birth to the Antichrist.
I like Hail Satan in the Living Room is like the title to something.
For sure. It is.
That's a good choice. Yeah. I think that's underrated.
Yeah, that's a good answer.
I will toss one other that, since about underrated, that people I don't think would think of this individual as a villain, but actually scared Jessica. I'll toss him because it bothered Jessica M. It still does to this day. Deus Ex Machina, the Garland movie from a few years ago, the android is absolutely, utterly terrifying. We're just insects to the... I don't know if you guys have watched
that.
I should.
But spoilers, massive spoilers, but essentially, you know, she tries to seduce and play upon the sympathies and is, you know, I'm a thinking machine and I do, you know, it shouldn't be possible, but I'm feeling emotions and blah, blah, blah. But the second she gets it, see that right there? The second it is free and that guy's going to die in that house. He's going to starve to death over months, probably out loose in the world. And all of humanity is simply a specimen to be dissected. And yet there's no ha ha ha, that there's nothing like that. It's just
right.
Alien. That creature is alien and yet has just enough semblance of humanity to ascribe motivation to it that, you know, I saw her point of view. That's a terrifying,
right.
That's a really effective. And I don't think most people think of the android as a villain because it doesn't go around murdering lots of people or anything, but just that one flash of, everything was pretense, was fabrication to get him into the trap so that it could be free. And then didn't even think about him again.
Is that, do you think that like,
it will never think about, she will, it will never think about him again.
Like when I think about recent horror films, I mean, who are like, even just the memorable villains like Jigsaw, I guess, from the Saw movies, and
Art the Clown from Terrifier.
Okay, I haven't caught up on the Terrifier movies, but I kind of think about like who are the big villains at the moment, you know, and in the sense even of like villains as characters. I mean, Michael Myers and Jason, I mean, I get that they're characters, but they're inarticulate, you know, and that's part of what makes them frightening, right? Is they're just relentless, these relentless killing machines. Leatherface is like that too. And I guess you could probably see them as a kind of like response to the loquaciousness of Dracula or something like that, or so many other villains that Vincent Price played, right? But you know, these days, I mean, you know, the Jigsaw character even has been turned into this kind of semi-righteous figure. You know, he's mm-hmm. he punishes hypocrisy and all this kind of nonsense. So I'm just sort of throwing that out there that I don't know if we have a good villain or good villains. Maybe Art the Clown, but that's just one, you know.
Yeah,
I'm not very familiar with those movies, but the sequences that I've seen, there's kind of a gleeful malevolence going on and a joy in violence and obviously the playfulness of the clown. It's an old trick, but this particular combination of actor and makeup really pulls it off.
Well, I feel like so many of the villains that we know at the moment are comic book villains, right? It's Thanos or it's Doctor Doom or whatever, you know? And I mean, they have their place too, don't get me wrong, but just as good horror villains, I don't know.
Yeah, for some reason I'm blanking on even thinking of like major horror franchises right now, outside of like Saw.
Well, you got like the Conjuring movies.
Yeah, but there's not really a central villain to those.
Satan, Nick. Satan is the central. Come on, excuse Nick. Excuse me. In the living room. But
callback.
Yeah, or Insidious. I mean, there's the Beyond or whatever it is. You know, but...
scariest movie I've ever seen.
Or what's the one? I kind of like these ones with Ethan Hawke. Was it Sinister?
Sinister.
I thought those were actually half decent. And there they have the boogeyman figure.
Mm-hmm.
But those, they only lasted like, you know, in a sense only, but they only lasted two movies, which isn't necessarily a bad thing because I think they make an effective pair of movies.
Yeah.
Creep. Nobody ever talked about that. Oh, yeah, that's actually, I didn't like the second one as much, but it was good. It was worth watching. But Creep, and I'll say he is sort of a franchise character because he's in the second movie. That's actually a damn good movie.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. It was and very a great effective. Villain.
So yeah, I recommend that one. Yeah. But you're right. There's a dearth.
He was just, what was his name? Joseph Joe, I think was his name in Creep. Mark Duplass is, I mean, he always impresses me, but
yeah,
he was just so unsettling the whole movie. Like he just gave off that perfect vibe of just like, something isn't right here. Even right from the very beginning where you meet him and he's like, hey, come on in. How you doing? Like there's just, he just gives that off. Like it's, yeah, he's so good.
Well, I feel like they've
he's
been
a perfect Brian Evanson character.
Yeah. I feel like there's films, you know, I enjoyed the heck out of Malevolent, or is it Malignant or Malevolent? Whatever that Malignant. One was. Malignant, which is just ridiculous, but I just loved it. And the same thing with Barbarian. I was just, you know, but
I loved Barbarian.
Also, they're kind of one and done. You know, it would be, I mean, I would kind of like to see how you would do a sequel to Malignant, but you know, that's maybe a whole other story, a whole other podcast movies that were, how would you make this movie?
Fun fact, Malignant is, so my dad is a total film guy. And Malignant is hands down, without question, the worst movie he has ever seen.
Nice.
And I still really enjoy it.
Right. Well, the thing with Malignant and Barbarian, right, is the science fiction writer A.E. Van Vogt once claimed that the way to write a story was every 500 words, just like have the story turn in a completely different direction. And it can be an interesting experiment to try, but I feel like these movies basically live by that rule. You know, that you're like, oh, it's this kind of movie. It's, oh, no, it's not. It's this kind of, oh, no, it's this kind of movie, you know. You know, there's something about the just the gusto with which they embrace their sheer insanity that kind of works for me. It's parallel for me to what you find in like Texas Chainsaw, to the extent of just we're just going to go 180 miles an hour just in one direction. You know, are they as successful as Texas Chainsaw? That's another story. But
yeah,
Nick, I love that your dad hates that movie. That's fantastic.
Oh,
that's good.
I mean,
you should be like, Dad, listen, I was on with these guys tonight, and they were like, Dad, is the greatest movie ever. See what he does.
They're film experts.
They're film scholars from the Sorbonne.
He'd be like, I don't want you talking to these guys anymore, son. They're bad influences on you.
You'd be like, Dad, right. they were talking about how they were screening it on the side of Notre Dame. They were just like, all of Paris was there cheering.
Yeah, that would break his heart.
No, actually, though, there were, you know, Damien Runga, who's an Argentinian filmmaker, has made a pair of films. One is called Terrified, Aterrado, and the other, When Evil Lurks. And those are very effective films. There's a certain, in both films, there's a certain kind of coherence that I feel like kind of frays a bit at the end, but they are remarkable and distinctive horror films. There's also one called The Dark and the Wicked. The Wicked and the Dark, The Dark and the Wicked, really unsettling. It's a demonic possession film that just, in a sense, takes nothing back. There's no like if you wanted to make the argument, you could say this is an extremely conservative film in that none of the characters believe in the devil and everything that your priest or minister or whatever warned you about happening, if you didn't believe, you know, if you weren't religious, that happens. It's a good recruitment tool.
Absolutely. Have you guys? There's a malevolence in those movies that I enjoy.
There was another movie, a demonic possession movie with Sean Patrick Flannery giving just an outstanding performance of Nefarious, I think it was called. Have you guys heard of Nefarious?
In prison.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I saw that one.
Death Row.
That's very, very sort of Orthodox Catholic, or you know, I would say Catholic really. It's that's one you can absolutely show in your religion class.
Right. Yeah. No, I like that one a lot. But no, I wanted to bring up a movie. Of course I'm gonna blank on the name. Was directed by Bobcat Goldthwait.
The Willow Creek. The Sasquatch one. Yeah. I like that one. That
movie had maybe the most effective third act from the start of the third act to the end credits I've ever seen in a movie. It is two people essentially in a tent for like, it's like 20 minutes or something, like it's a very long time.
Yeah. I found that film very effective for the same reason I found the Frankenstein thing effective, you know, the sort of big roaring monster that's outside and coming to get you.
Yeah. And I just, we were talking about just all these movies and yeah, that's one that has stuck with me since I watched it. I haven't seen it. I've only seen the movie, I think, twice, and I remember being even more impressed with it the second time I saw it. That was such a cool way to go about that, because I feel like, especially with something like Sasquatch, showing it could ruin the mystique surrounding it. Just, you know, unless you just straight up drop the wait, I was about Patterson Gimlin. I was about to say the Zapruder film. I don't think that's the Sasquatch one.
Isn't it though? Wasn't it actually Sasquatch who was there on the grassy knoll that
day? On the grassy knoll. Yeah.
Sasquatch was the grassy knoll.
Sasquatch was the grassy knoll, right. And baby Sasquatch. No, Mu Deng was on top of it with a gun.
And I had this thought before, another vaguely Lovecraftian movie, or maybe it's not so vague, but Cube. You guys familiar with Cube?
Yeah, I saw Cube in the theater, actually.
Yeah?
About a long time ago, probably on VHS.
They all got what they got. Yeah. That's what you get for getting in the goddamn Cube.
I mean, did they have a choice?
They had to do something. They had to do something to be there.
That's a fair point.
Not to forget Cube, but what about, is it Black Mountainside? The one where they're digging up, they've uncovered some kind of artifact, and it's just sort of slowly kind of poisoning everybody.
Chekhov's Bear Trap.
Yes. Now you went with it, yeah.
Black Mountainside?
I don't know. I think it's Black Mountain, it might just be, or Black
Mountain. No, it's Black Mountainside.
Black Mountainside, yeah.
And I thought it leaned way too heavily on some much larger, famous movies, but it did enough to separate, that it turned it more into homage than ripping off.
Right.
And where it goes is pretty, it warmed my cold heart, kind of where it went. I was like, yeah, good. I don't root for people in horror movies. I'm like, get them all. You missed one. She's hiding under the stairs, dude. There's a kid in the crib over there. Did you hear? Oh, it's going to cry. There you go. It's right over there.
I love it. Ruthless.
Yeah, get them all. Get them all. That's not a horror movie unless they all get got.
That's why I like Halloween 3. Put the masks on there and then just bugs and snakes pop out of their skulls. Yes. And I like to think it at the end that it worked. It was successful.
Right. We're supposed to be all upset because America's youth is all going to, they're all wearing masks. Like, no, we're pulling for the bad guy.
Speaking of Halloween, what do you guys think of Rob Zombie's, I guess just his whole body of work, even specifically, I suppose, his Halloween movies, but just, his whole thing.
I'll start off. Fuck no.
No, not a fan?
No. Not at all. Nothing.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know. I like Rob Zombie,
I like Brian Evanson's Lord of Satan. Lord of Salem.
Yeah.
That's it. The best thing about that was Brian Evanson adapting it. Yeah. Or not, novelizing it. I am not, and I didn't like him as a singer. Sorry, Rob. I mean, not a fan. I particularly just shake my head over the naturalization of Michael Myers. Fuck off. The only thing I'll give him a little credit for, a tiny little bit, but I'll snatch it away, is I like the idea that the kid wore a different mask for different moods. That was almost clever, and that's it.
That's fair.
And I'll cede the rest of my time to the honorable senator from Massachusetts. Or John Langan, who likes everything. One person who likes everything more than John does will apologize for anything is Stephen Graham. If you want to get people to apologize for Rob Zombie, you get those two. It'll be a whole podcast about how awesome they are.
A Rob Zombie Film Fest and
Music yeah. Fest. A Love Fest. It'll be a Love Fest.
A Love Fest indeed.
Yeah. I applaud his ambition, but he just has no aesthetic sense.
Yeah, I watched the Halloween one as long as I could, which was not. I think I did the crossword on my computer while it played. And then
we should get Nick's dad in here to.
He would tear him apart. And see, that's
somebody,
the good.
Somebody
like,
told me the second one is good. Rob Zombie's Halloween 2 is good. I made it.
They lied.
They did lie.
3 minutes in, I was like, nope, absolutely not. No.
They had no respect for your time, man.
No. That's 3 minutes I'll never get back.
At the end of your life, you'll be dying there thinking, Rob Zombie.
Damn you, zombie.
For the end,
and he took it from the good end.
Yeah, no, that's one of the biggest.
But Nick, it's fine if you liked it. We're not judging. I'm not.
Oh no,
he's totally judging.
No, I'm not.
I feel it. I feel the judgment. It's
you
fine.
Should. You should feel the judgment. Yeah. It's just like your dad, only it's Laird Barron.
I thought that the latest ones were even worse. So there you go.
That's fair. That's fair. No,
not a purist. I just think they all lost the plot. They didn't do anything interesting. And I'm very sympathetic I'm spacing on her, Jamie Lee Curtis. Yeah. I'm extremely sympathetic to her coming back as an aged Strode, but it just
didn't work for you. Yeah, no,
not even a little. I'm just like, I sighed.
Yeah.
Was it?
I'm much more in John's camp. And that's the biggest difference between my dad and I is my dad is...
Your dad has taste.
Probably. I think he'd be the first to admit he's overly critical about movies and forgets sometimes that, you know, movies are made to be enjoyed. And he's just hypercritical. Whereas
he's like, but how can you enjoy this?
Right.
He doesn't.
I like garbage too. I just...
Yeah, right. And he does too. I'm not trying to like criticize his... I don't want to get.
He's going
to
tear down that screen.
He's going to come right through that screen.
He's going to knock over the screen.
His giant gloved hands closing around your neck like some giallo flick, dragging you backwards.
Yeah, but no, I
like
everything.
This interview's over. This podcast is done.
You're never talking to these guys again.
Next week, it's all Bergman all the time.
Nick's screen goes black.
Just a Sopranos ending and no one ever hears from me again.
No one ever knew what happened to Nick.
His final message was don't stop believing.
But yeah, a Bergman marathon will be your punishment, huh?
Probably something like that. No, he'd have me do a Tarantino marathon.
Well, that's all right. That's
I'm going to do anyway. Yeah.
You can get away with that. Yeah.
I'll accept
it. Yeah.
Except for Death Proof, but you know.
Even Death Proof.
They can't all be winners.
Death Proof, I feel, is just right. No, like Death Proof, I feel, is a well made movie. It's just, it's the least Tarantino of all of his.
No, it's not. It's not well made.
I'm not even going to stoop to try to.
You don't think so? I don't know. I thought for what it was,
This is just me baiting Laird. This is just, it's the only thing that Laird and Nick Mamatas agree on is their love for Death Proof. They would fight to the death about everything else, unless it's Death Proof, and then they would join their evil forces to try to defend Death Proof.
Against Tarantino, who says he hates it too. Wrong! McLaughlin Group. Wrong, Quentin. You're wrong.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, in my eyes, though, Tarantino really can do no wrong. He's my all-time favorite, which is a super cliche answer, but...
You know what, though? I mean, sometimes... This does not specifically address Tarantino, but just I think sometimes you have to like forgive someone their success. You know, like sometimes I think you look at a director, at a writer, a comic book artist, whatever, and you're just like, well, you know, they're so successful, they can't possibly be any good. You know, it's like if everybody likes it, it can't be good. Whether everybody likes it or doesn't like it is irrelevant. It's you know, how does the work hold up on its own? And so, yeah, sometimes that means that you look at someone like Tarantino and he works for you and you know, think what he's doing has aesthetic merit. Good. That's all that matters.
And you're right. He is one of the greats.
Yeah. No, and I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood broke my frickin' heart, man.
I thought that was surprising. Like, after a few that I didn't love so much, that one knocked me backwards. I really love that one.
Well, the ending is just, and if you haven't seen the ending, people, then just, this is going to sound kind of cryptic, but just, it makes it clear that this is a fairy tale. And it's just so, like, it's just, that's like, the boom. Yeah, yeah.
That's really, yeah, that's really sad.
Yeah. And look, I love Kill Bill 1 and 2. I just, that scene where she kills all of the crazy 88, come on.
Oh, yeah.
It's Uma Thurman in a yellow tracksuit with a samurai sword. A Hattori Hanzo sword on top of that. So,
that's right. With
the, what more do you want?
Yeah.
Great soundtrack with Zamfir, Master of the Pan Flute.
True. His finest hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tarantino coaxed him out of retirement.
Yeah, that's right.
He was like, come on.
Well, guys, thank you so much for joining me today. I really do appreciate it. I think we got we learned about some valleys between our opinions on things today.
I think we got some libelous material is what you're saying.
Yeah, something like that.
I expect we'll be hearing from Rob Zombie's lawyer shortly. Or Rob Zombie himself
my dad.
Will just crash through the wall.
Like another Kool-Aid man? Screen will appear.
Yeah, exactly.
But Laird, Matt, John, thank you guys so much. I will I'll definitely be in touch with you guys. You guys have a happy Halloween.
Thank you. You too, Nick.
Thank you.
Oh wait, I should have said this before. Don't log off right away.
Right,
this is gonna be at the end of the episode. All right, take care, guys.